Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you can join us. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion. Now, if you need assistance, please select Lori Weber from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and then she will try to assist you via private chat. Today's topic is an update on the Public Safety Broadband Network, which we first addressed back in 2009. Now, activity to move this forward has picked up quite a bit in the past year or so. FirstNet was established within NTIA to implement an LTE network nationwide, and a board of directors were appointed. But most of all, we wanted to do this program now while the opportunity exists for first responders and emergency managers to provide input on this network implementation. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week, probably Monday. Okay, now it is my pleasure to welcome back today's speaker. Kevin McGinnis is a member of the board of directors of FirstNet, representing the first responder community. He has spent nearly 40 years in emergency medical services and advises several professional associations on technology issues. Please see today's background page for further biographical details and links to several related resources. In particular, I would like to point out the link to the Public Safety Advisory Committee list, which includes the names of the individuals representing those national associations that have been invited to participate. Now, I do want to mention we, partway through the program today, we will be running a short video, and in order to view it, you'll have to have something on your computer that will play a WMV format. So if you cannot see it, you will be able to access it later from a link on our background page. So welcome back, Kevin. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us again today, and I turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you very much, Amy. It's a pleasure to be back with you. Wow, 40 years. It's actually only 39. Don't need to make me feel prematurely old in EMS. It's my pleasure to be here today addressing this group from the perspective of the FirstNet board, a pleasure I didn't have the last time I was here. And I want to do a couple of things today to put this all in perspective. Now, first of all, let me start by saying the FirstNet board activity is only about 6 months old, and we've been apparently endowed in some people's minds as having prodigious capabilities to instantly create a system, and in other people's minds as moving too fast to do so. So we're probably striking just about the right balance in moving ahead in building this network. But what I want to do is give folks an idea of why FirstNet and why broadband from one public safety user's perspective, the discipline from of EMS, because that's the pond I swim in, and explain exactly where we plan to go as a national EMS community using broadband. Then I want to transition into a little bit about FirstNet and where it's come from, where it is today, and where we're heading with it, and what the capabilities are going to be, and then we'll have a healthy opportunity for questions and answers. So you may recognize these folks, usually about half of an audience does, who were trouncing across our TV screens in the early 70s on the show Emergency. At that time, that show gave rise to our first look at what paramedics are, at what life-saving capabilities EMS had the potential to have in the field beyond just being a horizontal taxi cab. And since then, from the 70s to today, about 40 years, and yes, I have about grown up with modern EMS, we've advanced our capabilities tremendously, so we really do life-saving things at the scene. One thing that hasn't changed, though, for us in that time has been the sophistication of the communication system. Basically, what we dealt with, what these folks are using in these pictures, are what we use today by way of VHF and UHF. We've added on 700 and 800 megahertz communications, but it's all narrowband for the most part. You know, basically 96% voice and maybe 3 or 4% data for telemetry and some other limited uses. In that time, recognizing those limitations and seeing that there were a number of technologies that exist today in hospitals and other settings that we're not able to use in the field because of the limitations of narrowband communications. About 5 or 6 years ago, I started holding expert panels and focus groups on communications issues, basically asking what kind of technology do we want to have in the field 5 or 10 years from now, and what are the communications capabilities and infrastructure, bandwidth, and the like that we're going to need to support that technology. And what I want to do is I'll give you sort of the overview of what the answers to those sessions were over the past several years, and then a few specific examples. So as an overview, there were four major needs identified. And to folks in emergency management in particular, these are buzzwords. But I'll tell you, in EMS, they really are virtually unknown as operational terms. Situational awareness, to us, having a perfect knowledge of the resources in the response area that you're going into on your next patient call, and knowledge of the events going around around you, which may interfere with your successfully completing that call or may interfere with resources you need because they're dedicated someplace else. Common operating picture, especially important for EMS because almost every patient call that we have involves more than one set of players. It's often first responders who get to the scene and provide care until the ambulance gets there, the ambulance crew, an incoming helicopter crew, an extrication crew for things like motor vehicle crashes and other extrication situations. And then there's always the doctor at the hospital who will give us orders or will monitor what we're doing and wants to know when we're going to be there. They all need their own situational awareness, but they also, this group of people, needs to share a common set of expectations about what's going to happen to my patient in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes so that we get it all right and the patient, the clinical decision-making is correct and the patient gets what they need. We also have an issue in EMS and police and fire as well of sequential processing. That simply means from the moment that a tone goes off to send us on our way out to a call, we get pieces of information which adjust our picture of what we're going to find at the scene or what we need to do at the scene. And every time we get a new piece of information from the getting the tone, jumping in the ambulance, hopping out of, getting out of the barn, and heading to the route, the new information may be, it's not the scene we thought it was. It's located differently. There's construction between you and the scene. You're going to need to route around it. The patient, we're getting some new patient information, and it's looking like they're really in bad shape, that type of thing. And so what happens is we get information, change our plan, information, change our plan, information, change our plan. And oftentimes it seems like we're wandering our way through a call, not really having the complete picture until we actually start to get there and it all becomes clear to us what our resources are, what the patient's condition is. And unfortunately, by that time, it's too late to make some decisions that might have cut short that patient episode and gotten us to a better place. It'd be better if we could get information, a lot of different information at the same time, that is parallel processing information, and also being able to send out information that we are processing from the scene on patient condition and whatnot to those who need to have it so that they can add to their situational awareness and the general common operating picture of everybody. So parallel processing is an important thing. And then, as I said at the outset, we have an inability to adopt technology that's available today, and we're going to explore some of those pieces that will definitely benefit our patients. Okay, first example, I get to my ambulance base to sign on duty, and I have really a blank slate when I walk through the door. I don't know much of anything going on in my response area, So I'll start off with find out who my partner is. We'll tackle an inspection of the ambulances for equipment and supplies being up to date for the electronics and the vehicle equipment working and that sort of thing. That takes 45 minutes for two ambulances. Then we want to check around and see what hospitals are open and taking patients, whether the trauma center is taking patients, whether the helicopter's in operation today, whether the ambulance service next door, which is a volunteer service, has a paramedic on, or whether I'm the paramedic for them as well today. Things like that can take upwards of an hour and a half to 2 hours to collect all that information from start to go. And I'll tell you, even before that 45 minutes inspection of the ambulance is over, we have our first call. So we're going out with incomplete information, incomplete operating picture, incomplete situational awareness. Picture this instead. We walk into the base and you see a picture like you see before you, which represents our response area for Ridgeway EMS-1, our ambulance. And immediately when we bring that up on our smartphone or our the tough book in the ambulance or the PC on the desk, we immediately have a picture of what's going on in our response area that's described as the response area geographically. And so immediately we know, looking down the lower left-hand corner, for instance, the inventory and status of the vehicles are both in the greens. If something was wrong, if a Band-Aid had walked out of that ambulance and triggering an RFID signal, that would be red. We'd click on that and see what was missing and put it back in. A lot less than 45 minutes to do that. And then all the other icons on here either display something instantaneously that tells you about that, like the hospital is on divert, the helicopters, one is available, one's not, and click on it and find out what the story is there. All of that is real-time information. If you don't see it on the face of it on the screen, you can always hit the icon and dig deeper for more information about those folks. So that's one way. We've just immediately, by being able to parallel process information on one screen in real time, give us a picture, save us an hour and a half to 2 hours, and 5 minutes, I'm ready to go out the door on my first call with a great situational awareness and presumably all the other players monitoring the same multi-source information gives them a common operating picture of their for us all to share. Here's another example. You probably heard of a term called the golden hour. Well, it's been well debated and somewhat debunked, but it's something that we hold to just to explain how time-critical conditions can be affected by faster response and a more appropriate response. Essentially, golden hour is the time from the moment that you suffer the injury that's going to kill you to the point that a surgeon has to get in, fix that injury so that it doesn't kill you. And it's whether it's an hour or 2 hours or 30 minutes, that's the issue of debate. But one thing that we know that it's not is 20 minutes for us to discover that the car crash happened that injured you, 20 minutes for me to go out in my ambulance and discover that you really are injured and life-threatened, 10 minutes to load you in the ambulance, 30 minutes to get to the local hospital, 2 hours to play around in a local hospital before they determine that you really need to go to the bigger hospital and 40 minutes to get you there. In today's era, in most places in the country with organized trauma systems and helicopters, that cuts that down quite a bit. You cut out the local hospital for the most part. But still, the golden hour does not equate to 20 minutes to discover that the car crash happened, 20 minutes for me to go out in my ambulance and discover that we really need to call the helicopter, 40 minutes for the helicopter to get here and 40 minutes for the helicopter to get back. Still doesn't compute. And those time-critical events are not limited to trauma. We now know that heart attacks, stroke, and other conditions have very specific windows of opportunity to fix the patient so the patient doesn't suffer in the long term with disabilities or die. So let's look at the alternative. Instead, we get an alert. Once that car crashes, OnStar or similar concierge services can send out a data burst. And that data burst provides information on exactly where that car is, the occupancy, the forces acting on that car, basically gives you a good picture of what happened to the car and what you might anticipate finding there. And in fact, advanced automatic crash notification will actually allow you to build in predictors of serious injury, as in this screen. And when you have that predictor, 92% probability of injury, all of the resources around you for which you want to have a common operating picture with can set up protocols. So, for instance, if that happens, the helicopter can simply say, if we get that notice in the first couple minutes after a crash, we're going to send the helicopter crew to the helicopter, start the helicopter, and perhaps even send it up. The trauma center may get ready to go. Extrication may automatically go. And then you now have this wonderful parallel processing of information going to multiple participants in this call. And so that by the time I leave the ambulance barn to set out, here's what we've saved. We saved the 20 minutes of discovering that the crash happened that injured the patient. We saved the need for me to go out to the car crash and find out and verify that it really was a bad crash. All the resources are en route. And that is going to significantly cut down, by our example, about 40 minutes worth of time in this event. And so when I roll out of my barn, instead of wondering what's going to happen next, I got a ton of information here about all of the folks that are responding to this and what the what my situational awareness is for this. Plus, we have access to DOT computers to get up-to-date directions to the scene so that we don't run into construction. And we know that we have the lights, the road lights, stop lights ahead of us are in our control, and some of the cars ahead of us know we're coming and some don't, so we've got to be careful. So some wonderful examples there. Another capability, when we're all heading to that scene, those that are going to do extrication can do just-in-time training because we know what kind of car it is. They can pull up on the screen a guide that will tell them the best place to cut in the car to get the patient out most effectively and what kinds of dangers to look forward to when they do that. Last example of my extended examples here, at the scene, some more parallel processing. When we hop out of the ambulance today, the process of going up to and looking at the initial car, maybe then moving on to another car, but in that initial car, assessing the first patient, getting information, communicating with them, really figuring out what's going on, and then communicating that patient to the hospital or the incoming helicopter or what have you, can take 5 or 10 minutes. So let's look at a different model. Instead, I hop out of the ambulance. Put on my video camera that's on my hat, it's a hat cam, that video in real time starts going into patient database number one. I start talking into a lip mic, dictating what I'm seeing about the car and the patient. That's being translated into a text file and going into patient database number two and being kept. We walk up, and I have in my hand a standoff vital signs monitor. I go a zip, like a, if you remember the Star Trek tricorder, those of you as old as I will know that I've just taken the vital signs of the patient without touching it. That goes into patient database number three, and I take a playing card deck size monitor, put it on the patient's chest, and those additional vital signs and EKG go into patient database number three. And then lastly, I either grab a chip off the patient in something they're wearing, or I go into the regional medical record repository and download the patient's pertinent medical record into patient database number four. And it kind of looks something like this. And for those of you that can see this, hopefully you will... work for you. And Amy, I'm not seeming to have control over that.
Okay, that's a possibility. Let me take it back, and I'm sorry about that, and see if we can run it. Again, if you cannot view the video, then it is linked from our background page, and you can see it a little bit later. Okay, now it should be run.
Okay. You'll remember how I said that process would take 5 to 10 minutes? Well, that exercise, and we've simulated this several times, that takes 60 seconds to populate those four patient databases. And now, in 60 seconds, the hospital can access those databases, the incoming helicopter can, anybody authorized to do that can access that. And we've just cut a good 10 minutes off of scene time per patient by being able to parallel process data like that. Some other technologies that have been identified in those groups that I've talked about include two-way video, probably not so much for urban applications because things happen fairly fast in an urban area, but if you picture in a rural area where you have a basic EMT as opposed to a paramedic who only does a handful of calls a year and gets stuck on a 90-minute transfer of a difficult patient going into the city hospital when the helicopter can't fly, the patient starts to turn a color they haven't, the EMT hasn't seen before. Wouldn't it be nice to have a virtual doctor in the back of the ambulance to look at that patient and provide advice? That's a need in the future. Community paramedicine is an up-and-coming deal where EMS folks are going to be providing primary care, but again, they're not going to be physician's assistants out in the rural areas in particular, so they're going to be using wireless telemedicine to communicate with the rural health center, let the doc see the patient or the PA see the patient, and that sort of thing. And the list goes on, and I'm not going to go into those. We have identified technologies that will allow us to monitor 21 or 42 or 63 patients at a time using a smartphone, use the same technology to monitor firefighters going into a burning building, and on and on and on. And 36 different technologies have been identified, to my knowledge, from these processes. And the one thing is that what I've had to say up until now when I've done this presentation over the last several years is, yeah, but, you know, we can't do that with the communication system we have today because narrowband won't support these applications. Now my tune has changed because now, as of this last year, we have FirstNet, a broadband system for public safety use exclusively, including EMS. And one of the things, for those of you that are aware of FirstNet and what was granted, and I'll talk about that in just a second, we have about $7 billion to develop the network. While that sounds like a lot of money, certainly more than I have in my checking account personally, it's not to develop a nationwide network, essentially a Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile of public safety, as it were. But one of the things that's going to be successful, that's going to make this successful, are applications just like this. When we get systems out there using applications like this, and the Kevin McGinnises of the world go down to see them in operation, I'm going to come back to my city, and I'm going to say to my city council or my state house, I got to have these applications for EMS. It's going to save patient lives. And we've got to invest in FirstNet in our state. And so we're not going to depend in the long run, hopefully, on federal dollars to make this happen. That's just a shot in the arm. But let's take a look at FirstNet. In about 2006, a concept of having essentially Verizon or AT&T for public safety exclusive use was broached. A fellow named Morgan O'Brien, who had been the head of Sprint Nextel for a while, a guy named Harlan McEwen in the public safety realm, came together with this idea of a public-private partnership where public safety could partner with an AT&T or Verizon or some other provider, and where bandwidth for broadband would be given to public safety, and public safety could share that with that private provider. The private provider would provide up-to-date, state-of-the-art technology and infrastructure to make this thing happen. Public safety would share its bandwidth with the private provider so that they get some benefit out of it. The FCC very much bought into that concept and developed it further and came out with a proposed auction of bandwidth in the 700 megahertz bandwidth to do this public safety broadband network. Unfortunately, for a number of reasons I won't go into here today, the necessary bandwidth auction that was held in 2008 failed, and so that private-public partnership didn't end up working. So the question became, well, so what? What do we do next? Because we still have this need for broadband, for all the things in EMS I described and for many more in police and fire communities. And so something called the Public Safety Alliance was formed of fire, police, public safety communications, and EMS organizations to lobby for a capability like this. And after a long, hard battle in D.C. on the Hill, which some of us still have nightmares about, the Middle Class Tax Relief Act and Job Creation Act of 2012 was signed in February of 2012 by President Obama, and it created the FirstNet, the First Responder Network Authority, or FirstNet, Public Safety Broadband Network. What that brought with us were a number of assets. It gave us, the first of all, congressional approval to go ahead and form this this network for public safety. It gave us 20 megahertz of bandwidth. It's called band 14 in the 700 megahertz spectrum, if you talk that language. It gave us $7 billion in steps based on future auctions of other bandwidth to build the system. It put together a board of directors for FirstNet, which consists of people who came out of the wireless network development industry. Our chairman, Sam Ginn, was a very successful wireless communications network developer, as were the others that he's attracted to the board. There are public safety folks, police, fire, and EMS, and sheriffs represented on the board. And there are some state and local folks represented on the board. But combined, all the talents you need really to direct at a very high level the spending of that money and the development of that network. We also have as assets the considerable amount of information that has come before us, and many of us have participated in the FirstNet, in the public safety world in anticipating broadband. NPSTC, the National Public Safety Telecommunications Council, has contributed a number of documents that inform this board and the technical expertise that the board is collecting to build a network. And if you haven't read the SAFECOM Statement of Requirements version 2.1, write that down, go online, Google it on the SAFECOM webpage. That will give you a scenario-based description where we're headed with all of this. And mind you, that document was written in 2004, but it holds true today. Out of those NPSTC documents, we have over 1,300 requirements that FirstNet has to consider that came out of the public safety community itself, requirements for what this network needs to do. This is a network of components. Obviously, public safety are players, as is our network, as are the wireless operators, the other commercial, terrestrial or land-based, the Verizons and AT&Ts of the world, and satellite providers will provide layers of additional capability for us to make our system more reliable, and other providers that I'll describe in a minute. There are basically, again, three components to what we see as our future system under FirstNet. Terrestrial mobile systems, our 700 megahertz band system that we own, that we license to be used as our primary network, and the other terrestrial systems, the commercial systems, mobile satellite systems where terrestrial systems, the cell towers and whatnot, don't reach. And then also systems on wheels or cells on wheels that we will maintain for disasters, areas where that infrastructure goes down, where the satellite can't come in, where we need to stand up a system temporarily. Solving several critical issues, we need to have instant interagency communication and collaboration. That means when somebody comes from Maine down to New Jersey storm like Sandy, that when we land on the ground, we have instant data communications that look exactly like we have them in Maine when we're using them in New Jersey, and obviously interoperability with existing public safety systems. We have to be able to talk one-to-many, one-to-one, push-to-talk capabilities, group communication on a nationwide scale, ultimately, mission-critical reliability through being able to layer on other networks where they're needed, with the focal network being the FirstNet network. Coverage into areas that are not now covered, and I'm going to talk about the rest of these, or I've already talked about the rest of those. So our chair likes to say we're going to cover every square meter, and, you know, I laud his optimism, and, you know, hopefully we can do that. It's pointed out to me that there's some very deep canyons in the United States where we may have some challenges, but that's certainly the goal, through satellite or terrestrial, to get out there. A you can bet your life on it network, available all of the time, that has a high reliability, public safety grade hardening appropriate to the locale. That is, we don't harden for earthquakes necessarily in Maine. We do in Tennessee, and so on and so forth, matching the need for hardening, but making sure that it's there and making sure that we use additional networks, commercial networks and satellite networks, et cetera, to build in that reliability. That we are not inventing a network from the ground up, a so-called greenfield development, but that we're going to explore existing infrastructure of towers and even water towers and other places where we might put antennas to make the system work at a lower cost. I described the 3-in-1 network. One emphasis here is on local management, and that simply means that though this is going to be a distributed nationwide network, by gosh, emergencies are local, and it's locales that need to define what their protocols are going to be for turning up certain capabilities and turning down capabilities under certain circumstances. For instance, I said that EMS might use a lot of video. That is bandwidth intensive, and if we have a mass casualty incident, we may turn off the video so that we can do multi-casualty patient monitoring. But how you do that and when you do that needs to be a locally managed decision, and that's what FirstNet is committed to. We are committed to excellent voice quality, better, equal or better to that, which we enjoy with commercial wireless today. And we recognize that while we want the best available speeds and throughput for as much data as possible, that, again, it's going to be matched by local managers, local and state managers, to the conditions of the response areas at that time. In that situation. Obviously, these communications for police in particular, for HIPAA purposes within EMS, have to be highly secure. We are not going to sacrifice anything in that regard. We are using LTE as our adopted technology for this system, and intend to maintain that as the most recent revisions or additions of that. And last, I just want to emphasize our goal is low cost. That is to say, when your ambulance service changes out the cell phones in the back of the ambulance, that putting in a FirstNet communications device will be affordable as putting in a newer generation of cell phone. That is our goal in terms of the equipment costs, in terms of the monthly charges in the system. Quite simply, we exist to serve first responders in this. That is our goal. We are not a profit-making situation. We do not serve investors. Our owners, as I will say in a second, are our colleagues in public safety. What can public safety folks, emergency managers, and other public safety colleagues out there as far as the development of the system do? Along with us, we keep on the board reminding ourselves of where FirstNet came from, the battles that we went through in Washington, D.C. to get the capability we have that's known as FirstNet today. FirstNet came from public safety and it exists to serve public safety. So we need to remember that public safety is the owners as well as the ultimate consumers or users. What you can do out there is identify through the state and local grant program process, which requires this, that NTIA is administering. Identify your state point of contact for FirstNet development. Every state's got to have one. Every state point of contact is supposed to have a representative body that represents you. Get on that body or make sure that somebody that you believe is a responsible party from your discipline is on that body to make sure that you are represented in decisions of who gets what bandwidth and how it's going to be used, and those decisions on, you know, in certain situations, turning up and turning down bandwidth, how that's going to be done. It's locally managed, but you're the local. And finally, again, we got to think about apps. It's the apps that's going to sell this this system, that's going to make this system work in the future. And with that, I turn it over to Amy for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. That's a very good introduction. Let's get to our Q&A. And if you want to ask a question or make a comment, select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel, and then type in the area underneath. And I'm going to close the chat panel so we do not get confused about which panel to put it in. All right. And then please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And once you've entered it, I will read the question out loud, and then Kevin will respond. We are ready to begin now, so please enter your comment or question at any time. And, Kevin, I'd like to just start off with to follow up on your last point on the state points of contact. My recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, the governors, I guess, are supposed to identify those by April sometime. Is that correct?
I can't give you the exact date. I know that a lot of states have, but yes, it is the governor's responsibility to do that. And you can go on the FirstNet website to get the date on that. But it's happening quick.
Yeah, and we do have a link on our background page to the state and local implementation funding opportunity announcement, and I believe that information is in there as well.
Right.
Okay, I have Jeff Pierce, who also is kind of following up on this, and I hope you can understand what he's actually asking here. He says, we have a 3-year performance period for phase one and two that we have funding for, or will be getting funding for, I presume. Again, these funds go to the state. He asks, how are others planning to sustain momentum on this process when we have an unfunded gap between planning and build-out?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that one of the things that we need to take as a mindset is that this is not necessarily a process where you are all at once building a statewide system. I think the planning has to be done on a statewide basis, clearly. That's the intention. But there are already a number of systems out there, whether they're citywide, countywide, region-wide, multi-city area, that have begun building to the end of having a network there. And so you're going to end up with a number in the statewide planning efforts, probably going to end up being a process of connecting a lot of those individual build-outs. But in order to do that, we recognize that states are at such different places in terms of their readiness for broadband, from nothing to having thought about it a lot and already having state points of contact and having interoperable executive committees or other committees that have been established that are going to be assigned as new tasks, that we can't we can't do, and NTIA didn't try to do something that applies to everybody in the same way. They tried to give some flexibility for folks depending on where they are. And so when you do that, you end up with this type of extended planning process, giving people time to get up to speed that need to get up to speed. Having said that, it's then a matter, I think, of really focusing on the early builders in states to support their activities and moving them forward, getting them to the point where they're starting to have developed effective applications that are, are being used and that can be shown in the rest of the state as examples of success. And then hopefully at that point there will be some local resources starting to flow into the mix and people won't be entirely waiting for infrastructure building. A good part of that initial two-stage first set of funding, planning funding, is the first part is to set up the structure in which you're going to do your planning and make sure that it's representative. The second part is to start analyzing your state capabilities so that you're not attempting a greenfield build, a very expensive build up from, from the ground floor with nothing, that you've identified infrastructure that is not only capable of supporting the 700 megahertz system, but the owners of that infrastructure, backhaul, antennas, towers, and that sort of thing, are willing to come to play. And I can tell you that, I'm not a techie, but I've watched some of these systems go up, and 3 years is not a huge long period of time to get those systems up and capable.
And I gather from some of the material that I've read about FirstNet that they're really hoping to leverage some of the existing assets that are already available in cities and states.
No question about it, Amy. We would be foolish to try and do that kind of greenfield build. It's just not necessary, and the assets out there are many. And it's not only physical assets such as black fiber and microwave and other things that are available there for backhaul. Mind you, I'm not a techie here, so start getting into terminology, may quickly get led astray, so I avoid that. But all of that, not only the infrastructure pieces that are out there, but also other forms of organized networking that are out there. I talked about the other terrestrial forms of network that are out there in the form of commercial wireless, large governmental wireless systems, satellite systems, and that sort of thing. We need to be looking at all of those, and we are. Our acting general manager, Craig Farrell, has been talking with owners of federal systems as well as state and local systems, trying to get a handle on what's out there and what it's going to take for FirstNet to be able to take advantage of those things. Issues that go down to, as sort of technical and mundane as, do we need to get environmental impact statements to use existing technology or existing infrastructure? What other kinds of bureaucratic hurdles are there to be able to adopt the offers of other people's infrastructure? It'd be nice if we could just do a handshake and go ahead and use it, but it's, of course, not that simple.
And I gather that's part of what the phase two is about, is collecting that data on those assets, that type of thing?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Let me go on to Rich Van Dam, who asks, how does this interface, or maybe the word is interoperate, if it can, and he's talking about other systems such as UICDS and Virtual USA. There may be other, examples of that.
Good question. I think that And, you know, mind you, again, I'm not the techie here on this, but at a high level from a policy point of view, when I look at the way Virtual USA, as a for instance, works and sharing common operating picture, situational awareness, data, there certainly is the potential for the network to be involved in that sharing of data. Whether that's that makes Virtual USA more capable than it is today. I haven't kept recent tabs on Virtual USA and its spread across the country and other similar situational awareness capabilities. But it certainly seems to me, and I've heard discussed, that that the network, the FirstNet network, could play a role in data transmission and probably should play a role because of its ability or our intended ability that we have immediate nationwide communications capability.
And I understand that FirstNet is about to start a pretty intensive outreach effort themselves, and that part of that will be to the vendor community to engage them also for their ideas, right?
You're absolutely right. We have our outreach program right now is under the direction of Jeff Johnson, who is one of the fire representative on the board and temporarily serving a stint of duty as a staff member until we hire somebody into that position. And he's done a very capable job of organizing what will initially be some regional meetings coordinated with the National Governors Association, to begin to get a picture of how the various states in regions across the United States, how well prepared they are at this point and what the variation in preparation is, but that we will also then be going out state by state and looking more specifically at what state and local preparedness is like for implementation of this program, which will obviously impact exactly how we roll the network plan out ultimately. And yes, industry, our leaders, Sam Ginn, the chair, Craig Farrell, the acting general manager, and others that have been assigned, have been talking with some of the major components in industry, the commercial wireless, the heads of commercial wireless carriers, to begin the conversations about how we're going to interact with those entities as additional resources to be drawn upon by public safety. Once we have established the plan to communicate with, be very transparent to public safety and its community, then we will further elaborate on our plan to communicate with the vendor community because we recognize there's a wealth of talent out there that we'd like to tap for our developmental purposes, but we also need to have a process to tap that talent in a way that's fair to all parties because it's a competitive world out there.
Yeah, and I bring that out just because we may have a few vendors here today. Okay, let's move on. I had a question from Wayne Ozio. He first asked, are there any deadlines? I asked him to clarify any. So he's asking, are there any deadlines or time frame for each state and counties to begin to implement?
The only deadlines that are pertinent right now are deadlines associated with the SLGP grants, the state and local grant process for that we talked about earlier. And I would just refer you to that website because I'm not doing dates off the top of my head. But as far as the rest is concerned, in general, you will, I would say, no, other than the state and local planning process itself, you got to get ready and get involved in becoming a participant as your state is ready. And there is a process that will kick in which states have to respond as to whether they are going to participate fully in the system or whether they are going to, quote, opt out, unquote. Those states will still have to play within the system, but they'll be able to develop their own radio access networks and the like in the way that they want to, as long as the network interoperates with the FirstNet network. And that is dependent, that time frame is dependent upon some things that FirstNet needs to do in terms of defining its plan of action going forward and actually going out and sending out RFPs for system development and clocks start within that process or after that process.
Since we're kind of on the topic of grants, let's move to Sanford Outshoal, who asks, is the grant funding all being administered by the state administrative agency? And I think this, again, goes to the point we talked about earlier about identifying those, the governors identifying those state contacts. Would that be correct?
Correct. But whoever the governor sets up as the point of contact is that's the
point. And it is very likely that it may be the same, you know, if that's already set, if they're already set up. So.
It could be, yes.
Yeah. Okay, Len Clark asks, what's the interaction between FirstNet, which supports broadband, and I'm hoping you know what this acronym is, Kevin, because I'm not sure I do, and NPSTC, which stated in its report that there is not enough bandwidth?
The interaction, NPSTC is the National Public Safety Telecommunications Council. You had me scared there for a minute, but I know.
Good.
And I sit on that, so.
Good.
The relationship between FirstNet and NPSTC is that NPSTC has preceded FirstNet through the period when we were looking at the private-public partnerships I talked about, the 2007-2008 period. Back as far as then, NPSTC was beginning to develop requirements of the public safety community for this broadband network, whatever it was to become. And ever since then, they've refined that, and as we've come to the FirstNet network today, they're the ones that have generated those 1,300 or more requirements that I talked about that FirstNet is very seriously considering as it moves forward with its network building plan. When NPSTC at one point said that we wouldn't have enough bandwidth, there was a point in our developmental time when one of the battles that we were fighting were with certain government agencies as well as certain commercial wireless providers who felt that we didn't need 20 megahertz of bandwidth. Subsequently, folks like Andy Siebold, who's well known in the public safety communications world, and NPSTC, folks at the Public Safety Research Communications Research Laboratory have done work which has demonstrated in the past that 20 megahertz is going to serve us for a while, and in and of itself may not be sufficient down the road. But you know that's what we were shooting for initially. We're glad that we got that rather than 5 or 10, which other people were trying to aim us towards. And I think, we folks that sit on NPSTC are very content with where we're sitting right now.
Good deal. Okay, we've got about 4 or 5 questions left. Kevin, I'm going to try to get through all of them, so we may have to shorten it up a little bit so we can. Isabel McCurdy asks, she says, access to personal medical records is a privacy issue. How do you get permission to do that? You mentioned HIPAA during your presentation, which are those privacy regulations here in the U.S. And perhaps you could just address this whole security type question in response to Isabel.
Sure. That's actually pretty easy. Either you wear your medical record on you and you offer it up as an emergency thing that gets put into a smartphone slot. So that's easy, secure, you're giving permission. Or you've agreed to have your medical records submitted to a regional repository of medical records. That cannot happen without your permission. That is, when you go to your doctor's office, they very well these days may have you sign a statement that says, my record can go into, in my case in Maine, it's called Maine Health InfoNet. And now my record is available to any other provider, any hospital I go to in the state, and any ambulance that happens to be on the scene needing my record. But I've given permission. So that's the health answer to that.
Very good. Okay, another one from Stanford. And he says, is it safe to say there is an intent to get this implemented on a regional basis versus individual communities?
It's actually our intent to get it established on a national basis, so that on a national basis we're going to have certain things that are shared everywhere so that we can have that instantaneous, ubiquitous communication that we might need in some situations. But having said, and so that we can, when we go from place to place to place in certain situations, storms or other disasters, that we can have instantaneous on, that we have the same communications interoperability there that we have back home. Having said that, we do intend that there be local, development, local management that goes to questions of who's going to have priority in your locale for what kinds of situations, and who does not, or what kinds of applications have priority under certain situations. Those are intended as all regional or local decision making. And, you know, we do believe that a lot of the early build outs are going to be cities and counties and other locales, as opposed to perhaps larger approaches. But that's just a matter of those that are already doing it or already giving it thought.
Okay. Alona Barner, she says, the law requires FirstNet to use LTE technologies, but if the planning phase of this effort will take up to 3 years, by the time we're ready to build networks, LTE will be obsolete. Will we have to amend the law in order to keep current with technology?
LTE will not be obsolete in 3 years. We are now looking at, there are versions of standards for LTE that are coming out routinely, which update the capabilities of LTE. As a for instance, one of the things we have not cracked with LTE is voice communications, push to talk. Those capabilities are now being planned in LTE for future versions of LTE, which will not appear until 3 years from now. That LTE is going to be obsolete in 3 years really is not true. It's going to be evolved, but the systems that we are establishing today or would establish in the next 3 years are not going to suddenly be subject to wholesale discarding.
Yeah. So FirstNet will, or the National Public Safety Broadband Network will evolve along with LTE technology, correct?
That is absolutely correct.
There you go. All right. A good question from Dr. Tom Talon, and I think this is the last one we're going to have time for, but this is something I thought you might be interested in. He asks, will this health information system work or coordinate with ER, HMS from the CDC and National Response Team?
Good question. I don't know that that's – we certainly haven't thought that far ahead. In the EMS world in general, that is the national EMS community, hasn't thought about how we're going to do that. And that's sort of regardless of FirstNet or not, how regional repositories for patients' electronic data are going to be shared for preparedness purposes is a whole other matter. Now, once those policies are established so that data is allowed to flow between regional repositories of health data and preparedness coordinators, then yes, absolutely, FirstNet can be a part of that data pipe.
And as far as specific federal systems, I believe a phase has been identified by FirstNet already where they will actually focus on those federal systems, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to need to wrap it up for today. So, Kevin, on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, thank you very much for joining us and sharing this information. We wish you good luck as this effort moves forward, and we think they are very lucky to have you on board.
Thanks, Amy. My pleasure.
And one thing I do want to point out, another link on our background page, they are planning a June workshop conference on this in Colorado, and that there's an open invitation to register and go, and the link to that information is also on our background page. Are you going to that, Kevin?
I sure am.
Good deal. Okay, folks, before you do run off, please take a moment to give us a little feedback. And then our next program is scheduled for April 10th when we will present an update on the implementation of the new National Flood Insurance Program provisions that were passed by Congress nearly a year ago. Our guest will be David Miller, Associate Administrator for the Federal Insurance and Mediation Administration, and Kristen Robinson, who has been coordinating the implementation for FEMA. Please do make plans to join us then. Again, this afternoon we'll have the recording posted. You can come back and look for that if you're link it on to others. We do thank everyone for participating today, especially all the good questions and comments. We really do appreciate those. So make plans to join us next time. In the meantime, have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.